Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson with the Digital Education Podcast. It's an exciting time for me because we've had a little bit of a break, and it is the beginning of summer for me, but I'm with a friend, with somebody from Australia that I've interviewed before who shared about his research on leadership, especially next generation leadership, Daniel Pompuk. And Daniel has become a friend, and I've just, every time I spend time with him, I learn more and I grow, and there's just such a depth of resource that I found available. So it's always fun for me to connect him into, you know, my interests in my world. And recently Daniel posted on Twitter regarding some details from an Australian research that he's been a part of and he's done, and that his schools in Australia are looking at, and it deals with teacher and educator well-being. And that's something that's, you know, part of my interest. It's part of something I know in North America, and especially in the United States, we're really struggling with. And so, Daniel, in that research, you found that depression, anxiety, even alcohol abuse, and even just overall health is significantly, whether it's significantly or statistically significant, that it's worse for educators than it is for other, you know, professionals in Australia. And I think what we're doing is we're seeing those same things here in the United States in particular. Tell me more about what you found, and then what this means for you as a leader of a school association in Australia.
Yeah. Thanks, Eric. Look, it is interesting. So we have a number of wellbeing surveys that are done in Australia each year. And often they're targeting around looking at the workforce and how many people are retiring, you know, levels of health, you know, any kind of ailments that people are having. And what we find in a schooling context is that, particularly with leadership, there's a lot of statistics that would say that people who are leaders in schools for a prolonged period of time actually have major health concerns. And some of those are that they require medication, or they think they're carrying extra weight, or their life expectancy when they retire is actually quite much shorter. So the question then is around what are the psychological impacts upon staff? And if there are psychological impacts upon staff, whether they are leaders or teachers, does this then flow onto the health of the community? And so in a faith-based context in a Christian school, you know, community and the health of the community is really central. So Christian Schools Australia has been working with a group called Johnston and Goldsmith, who have developed a set of resources called PeopleBench. Now, the interesting thing about Johnston and Goldsmith is that they're a consulting group of psychologists. And when they look at a whole range of different industries, such as government, or they look at hospitals or healthcare, etc., there is a huge amount of data that ties in human resource factors to the performance and how well those organisations run. But when they did and had a look at schools, in particular faith-based schools, they realised that there was a dearth of information that was available to them. And what struck them was that here is a very much a people-intense industry, a service-based industry, that does not have a lot of data around how its people provide that service and the factors that may either add to what was taking place or detract from it. And so what they did was then decided to do a qualitative research about 155 principals across Australia. And the first thing they wanted to do was have a look at principal sentiment to ask them, you know, what is your perspective of now and what is it of the future? They also wanted to see how did performance and professional development impact upon the workforce, and then also look at that talent pipeline coming through. So they looked at a whole range of different factors that were there. And what came out that was striking is that there were four major themes that came out of their study. The first theme that came out was that age makes a difference to student performance. So when they went through and had a look at that, there was an issue that was there. So this was followed up, I should say, by a quantitative study. So let me just do the qualitative first, and then I'll go on to the quantitative. So the first bit and part of the qualitative was what were the factors that actually that they thought were of impact. And the first one was staff well-being was huge. Their own leadership style was another one. The type of professional development undertaken, number of staff sick days, etc., were probably the top ones that they thought impacted on student outcomes. But when they started to do a research piece and actually look at the staff data, now looking at all the results that come out of the school in terms of the business department or the HR department in a school. So the first thing that they looked at was how many sick days did staff take? What were the age of the staff? What were their levels of qualification? How many had actually called in and were now on stress leave or sick leave, et cetera, that was available? And then what they did was correlate that to student academic outcomes. And we've got what's called NAPLAN results here. So every 2 years in grades 3, 5, 7, 9, we look at the literacy and numeracy results of students. Are they at the national average? Are they at the same average for schools that have the same socioeconomic background as them? And are there any gains that were taking place? And so when they compared on a qualitative study, which was what were the perspectives or points of view of the principals, to what the data said, they worked out that it was actually something really quite striking. The quantitative data said that older workforces actually have better impact upon student results. And then there was a question of did age act as a proxy for experience. The second one was that female leaders made a big difference in terms of student achievement. So if you had a female principal or head of department or deputy principal, etc., and a higher range of female leaders, that made a bigger difference. And the view there was that often for men in the profession, they looked at a lot around the economics and the accounting and building and a whole lot of programs, where the females were actually focused on teaching and learning, which seemed to be a striking difference. And the third one was staff qualifications. And that was that the more staff that had master's degrees, the better the student outcomes. However, this reached a saturation point when people hit doctorate. So if people said, I've got to go on to do my doctorate to get improved marks, that didn't hold true, but getting master level degrees did. And the fourth one was about the use of casual staff. And this was a striking one to say, where there were projects and bits and pieces, rather than try and bring on people for a full-time occupation, that moving now to project-based work, where we could bring on a person or a group of people to complete a project or release staff to do projects and bring in casual or part-time staff, had a significant impact upon the results of students. And so what we see that all of these had a reflection on the ability to build community, but also to take some of the stresses out of the community as well. So that's okay. Eric, can we just pause for a second? Can we just pause the recording?
Daniel, after a short pause, because you got an electrician at the house and life goes on, and it's a great example of just kind of the work that we do and the lives that we live and education, where so much of what we're doing is impacted by life and by other people and about things that go on. You know, when you think about like this research and when you look at it, a lot of it started with the work you did with Rob Lowe with relational schools. Kind of, yep. You use the framework around talking a lot about community and well-being. And in our last podcast conversation, we talked about the teacher shortage and, you know, and issues with leadership. I think people recognize that our profession has changed. The encouraging part about what you're finding in some of those four findings is that there's ways to change with it.
Yeah.
And let me ask you a school leadership question before we go kind of big picture again. If you were a school leader and you're kind of coming up on a midterm break, you know, here in Australia and in your school year, if you're a school leader and you know the reality of the difficulty of this job and what it's doing to faculty and to staff, like what would be some things that you would begin to change about what you do and how you do it? Yeah. Especially since you have been a seasoned school leader and because you see a lot of different school leaders at work.
Yeah. I think the first one is around a set of boundaries is that when we work, we work hard, but we also need to take decent breaks that are there. And I might think around, you know, that's what I refer to as psychological space. So if we've got staff who are interacting, huge numbers of interactions with people all day long, students, staff, parents, etc., the concept of psychological space has got to be really important of where they actually shut down and where they actually have time to revive. And that's on a daily basis where they're actually saying, work is now finished for the day. And for the ones who are digitally connected 24/7, it's about having that space to revive. The second thing is then around having other interests outside of school. And I think the problem is, particularly in a faith-based school or a Christian school, is that people often make the school not only their place of work, but it's a place of worship. Often, particularly for schools who've got churches attached, the staff become their friendship group. Sometimes it even becomes, they've got family members working there as well. And there's a sense where they put everything into one basket. And what happens if something goes wrong in that school environment, their entire world collapses. And so it's really healthy, I think, for all members of a school community to have a diverse range of networks and connections that aren't overlapping with each other. The third thing is that I would be saying is they need to have an out. What do they do that actually gets them away and separates that? And some people like to go hiking, some people like to go fishing, some people play sport. And what you find is that young staff do this extremely well. Once they finish school or they finish college, they've got a lot of interests. They're doing sport, they're socializing extensively, they've got friendship groups and circles, etc. But once you get into the staff world, these start to diminish. And so those other things that would take us away and provide us with a different perspective or different vantage point are gone. The other thing that I would be saying is that, particularly in leadership, is that the longer you are in a role, the heavier people lean upon you. So in the first couple of years, you strive to actually connect with the community and get involved, and you turn up, we use the expression in Australia, you'll turn up to the opening of a paper bag just to get, feel part of it, and to be seen and for people to actually value. But once you get past, I think, about the 5 or 6 year mark, it's now the reverse, is that people know you so well, and that people trust you, that they start sharing more and more of their life with you, and that kind of counselling support that you provide becomes quite heavy. And the same happens with families and students, with staff members as well. And the question of whether how we maintain ourselves in that context, or then say we need to exit and start afresh again in a new community. Because you look at other professions which are highly people intense, such as hairdressing or being a waiter or something like that. These people turn over very, very quickly in their professions because there is a sense of being consumed by those people that they actually need to have a psychological break from that group so that they can actually begin again and start those boundaries at a healthy space. So I think in a schooling context, that's something that we, that we need to be able to do as well.
So with this work and with some of this, and now you being in like the bigger picture of an association where, so you support leaders, you support schools as they support their teachers, as those teachers do the work, like what are some of the other, like projects you're working on or big picture questions that you're asking that say, hey, how do we, whether we solve this issue or how do we help bring greater sense of health, well-being, and even some of that idea of just enjoyment, or to use Gallup's word, engagement, right, to the work that we do.
Yeah, and I think it's important. There are various things that we need to be aware of, and I'll be saying we need to take a bit of a framework approach. And I say this just knowing that I don't want to cause people more work to do. So we're saying, let's talk about well-being. And here's now a compliance framework to put over the top of that to make you feel better. But I do think that in Christian schooling in particular, there are a range of frameworks that we need to be aware of that actually bring about health, that are good in terms of holding us to account. And one of the ones that we have been recommending is from the authors called McEwen and Winwood. And this is a framework they came up with in 2011. And it's called the Raw Sustain 7. And the really interesting there is it looks at 7 aspects of what actually makes a healthy community or a healthy organization. And so the first two, I think Christian schools do really well. So the first one is living authentically. That was a thing that we need to do, is that we're, we know who we are, we know what we stand for. And I think as a Christian, we live authentic lives. It's not that dualism that I go to work and I'm somebody else, but this is actually key to who I am. So often I've had a conversation with some of our politicians that's their work persona and their home. And I have to say to them, as Christian schools or as Christians, who you see at home, who you see at work, who you see social, etc. That is supposed to be who we are across our lives. So we do that, I think, in the main very well. The second one we do well is finding your calling. You know, what is the higher purpose to what we do? And we would say in Christian schooling, that's our vocation. So for the first two, we would do tick. The second one, the third one that's there is about maintaining perspective. And remember what I said before around, do you do other things besides just work? Some people's lives is just totally overwhelmingly focused on their work. And we do need to step away from our work to give a perspective to say, you know what? We can give this such a high significance that any little thing that goes wrong or a problem that takes place, we don't balance that well because we're not saying, well, you know what? My family's just as important. My health is just as important. And so having that balance and perspective, and so finding that perspective is really important. Managing our stress, I think one of the things that, you know, that we cut out of our lives is things like exercise or eating well. You know, they're the things that would help us to you know, do our time management or setting boundaries around what we're doing. So managing stress is another key aspect. The fifth one is around collaboration and cooperation with other people. So we seek support and we offer support. And I think in terms of being in a profession, sometimes we are afraid to ask for help and because we're supposed to be the educators, we're supposed to know. And so it's a dangerous point for us that we are the font of knowledge, where that's in the change that we're experiencing in schools at the moment and have done over the past 10 years. Change is so, it's just so overwhelming that the only way we will cope is by collaborating together and seeking support from each other. Staying healthy, eating, sleeping, all those kind of good things. And the last one is about building networks that are out there. So identifying where we can then grow and develop and have those other people outside of areas. And what I love about these podcasts is that you grab a group of people together with different ideas from different backgrounds, and that kind of builds this web of understanding and knowledge that is there. And so those seven areas are really important. But I would say that in the Christian schooling context, we overemphasize the first two. We're focused on that authentic living and that finding the calling. And I would call that a martyrdom syndrome, that unless we're dying for the profession, then we're not doing it right. And some people, to feel like they're doing enough, get to the point of nearly burnout before they go, all right, I've done this. And so you can tell those people, because when they go on a break, they either get sick or they do this, what I call a collapse, where they collapse and they just become almost catatonic for the first 2 weeks of a break. And they don't want to socialize. They don't want to go to shopping centers. They don't want to go to movies or restaurants because there's just too many people around. And that's that kind of, that's that overdoing it. That's where they have to get to the point of exhaustion before they feel like they're doing it enough. And so in a sense, it's about putting balance into those other five categories to say, are we doing those to the same degree? And you cannot, you know, overdo the other two if you still focus on the other five as well. And I think when you compare this research to what happens in hospitals or health organizations or government, etc., the two they need to focus on are the two that we don't need to focus on. So they need to be authentic. They need to have a higher calling and a purpose to what they're doing. But in a Christian schooling context in particular, we need to focus on the other five, or else the well-being of our staff diminishes greatly.
So you'd mentioned something. There's so much in this. So it's probably like, you know, and I always love the fact that you point me and point others to so many incredible resources. So I know that this podcast is only an entry point for a lot of this other information. But, you know, getting to know you, getting to know the Australian context a little bit from afar, getting to know some of the people that you've introduced me to in Australia, I'm interested in kind of that framework, and especially the framework of the collaboration. And Australian schools, at least to my perspective and to my knowledge, have been innovative and ahead of the curve on changing to become more collaborative, to be more open. And you and I had the opportunity to spend some time while we were in Texas visiting, you know, some American schools that were, you know, new, and even in their newness were not set up for collaboration. And
yeah.
Can you help me understand, like, you know, just even work design or what you're seeing in Australia where people are finding fulfillment in some of those innovative practices that not only make, you know, our work better, but then also make our work more enjoyable?
Yeah, for sure. I think, look, let me go across a couple of things. One of the great examples to have a look at is the ability to experiment and to play. I'm going to use the word play. Now, if we talk with early years educators, they would say play-based learning is one of the key aspects of letting students to learn and to gain skills. We also talk about risk-taking and experimentation and inquiry-based learning with our older students. So this is something we actually teach, but we actually don't practice a lot of the times to say, if you give a staff, here's a new program, here's a piece of technology, and you say to a particularly an older staff member, now I just want you to have a play with this and just get used to it, etc. No, won't do it. They will be saying, it's a waste of time, you know, give me a project to do. So they won't use a program until it's actually towards some kind of work-related activity, that this is going to produce something of worth or merit. So then what happens is that the stakes then of getting it right the first time just go through the roof, and saying, so now I've got to master this program or this activity or something my first time round. Now, you would have to be a prodigal genius prodigy or a genius to be able to do that. And so in a sense, it's a freedom to say, it is only through that play or that trial and error, the fact, and we can do it without it having to amount to something. And so younger generations do this very easily. Our older, more mature generations really struggle with the fact that they can actually just take something home and play with it and find out what it does, etc. So the ability to play. But play also goes better when you play with others, you know, not alongside. And we work that as a developmental for little children. We see, can they even sit at a table? Can they play? You know, and it's separate play, but then they can actually now start collaborating with others. And it's a sign of relational development that we actually can play well with others, you know, and that on a report card, if you go to a child does not play well with others to their parent, it's sending pretty clear signs. But we've got to do that ourselves in terms of, when do we allow our staff to come together, to actually spend time together, to laugh, to be able to work through things and come with that idea. And there's a really important emotional part here that I'm connecting with other people, that we're sharing a journey and we're being incarnate. And we see the stories of Christ all the way along, where he's walking and he's talking and they're going to weddings together, they're having barbecues on the beach, they're walking down the road together, and they're spending time together. And there is a really important psychological component to this, where we actually spend time with others, where we actually get a sense that we're journeying with others in terms of that space. So one is to say, it's not wasted time. So being together is not wasted, or experimenting or trying out this thing is not wasted. But also it means that we don't have to carry all of what's taking place. So we can then say, I know what my weaknesses are. Somebody else on my team, that's a strength area. And so we then distribute the tension or the stress in terms of what is taking place. But also we make our work more three-dimensional, because we're actually having the perspectives from three or four different people coming in. So many of our work teams are at a year level based. We'll have, you know, all of the year threes will be working together in terms of their planning. Or if it's in the high school, it'll be all the maths teachers or the English teachers will program and work together. But even more so, they will team teach often in that time. And again, being able to go around and not be all things to all people. When it comes to assessment or setting things up, or even observing each other's classes, has been a really important factor. So take that one step further, and some of the PD that we're doing to people is to say, don't go off and do some whiz-bang conference or go to a one-day seminar. How about we release you for the afternoon and you go down the road to your favourite school you've always wanted to do and spend the afternoon making more friends and more connections outside the school with all the grade three teachers from that school or this school, or all the English teachers or all the maths teachers that are happening there. And in a sense, there's that again, a perspective about their own context, again building a bigger network, again being able to go out and do this without any kind of you know, we've just spent $500 sending you to this conference, let's get all the things back, you know, from that, because it's a low expense type thing. And what we see is then again, staff starting to develop and improve, you know, in terms of their own well-being, but their connections, their perspectives, etc., the techniques that they're seeing actually in practice that is there. And so not only is it beneficial for them, but it's actually beneficial for the people that they go and see, and then they're having people into their own classes. And so it takes the classroom from being this kind of, isolated space where the teacher comes in and they're set apart. It's a lonely experience, to one that's not only connected, but one that has other people invited into in a continuous way. So that sense of collaboration, participation is a must, and I think is probably what we look for as a sign of a good school in Australia today.
It's so exciting for me to, you know, kind of hear some of these things, because, even in that framework where you talk about collaboration and even network, just even that idea of collaborating within you know, kind of your organization or your school, no matter how small or big it is you begin to, you know, build that network that's important, but then you go visit those other schools that are across town or in your community doing similar work, but maybe, you know, slightly different, and you begin to build. So it's interesting how you look at, you know, just the expansion of my world, the connectivity of myself to other people in my professional world, and how that just kind of elevates just who we are, what we see, and what we think is possible to accomplish, not just by ourselves and our own work, but because we're in it with, you know, all of these other great people.
Yeah. And I think so. One of the other things that I would ask, so when I would do interviews for promotion positions, such as a head of department of an English or a year level coordinator for grade three or something, one of the questions I would ask them is, can you tell me the school that you think is currently doing best practice in your area, whether it was an English teacher or a year three teacher? And often the response would be, oh, that's a good, great question. But, and I go, I know, I asked the question. That's why it's a great question. You know, this is, I want an answer to it. But if I was to say I had a heart condition, and it was a very specific heart condition that I wanted to have a doctor look at or a specialist look at, you know what? I could look up online and look up that condition, and very quickly there would be a whole range of papers or people who would be the world's expert or my local expert in that area. And it's interesting in terms of education that, not that we need to do a write-up on who we think is the best person, not on a scale, but how do we actually find out, you know, and for us about, you know, maybe it's online scores or data, or, you know, we have best schools, you know, surveys that are done, et cetera, about finding where the best practitioners are in our areas and actually celebrating that and getting alongside of them and to see what that's like. And sometimes that's good because, you know, there's a range of factors. We might say, well, the reason why they're performing so well is that it's the socioeconomic background that they're coming from, or they've got such low teacher to staff ratios, or they've got lots of tutors working in that school, or whatever. Doesn't matter. But when we look back to ourselves and we say, but what would we judge as best practice? What do we see as being actual gain for our students? The conversation changes a great deal. And again, that's that vantage point. That's a simple thing to say. We're not just in that same rut, wearing ourselves down and down, because what happens if we keep doing the same things without getting a different perspective? Or the only option we have available to us is to work harder and longer. And then again, when we do that, our performance drops. And so we're tired now and we're exhausted and we're trying to get the same results with somebody who's now working at 80% rather than 100%, where we then actually be able to take the perspective and say, you know what, that actually doesn't make an impact whatsoever.
Well, it's interesting that you point out, and maybe we just kind of ended here, you know, earlier you talk about play and how play is so important to just learning and growing and developing. And that's something that I've tried to find ways in my own life, in my own heart to just play at my work and play at what I do and, you know, just be around the friends that are doing the work together and play. But I think there's also that connectivity to what you talk about. Is it's really interesting that sometimes what I see is the most healthy and vibrant, you know, schools and learning organizations are the ones that celebrate well. They celebrate each other, and they're not foolish to the limitations of their celebrations. They're not foolish to the work that still lies ahead, but they celebrate their work well, they celebrate each other well, they celebrate, because so often in education we do see the constant critique that just draws down, never good enough, we'll never get there, there's always something, where instead of, you know, celebrating the progress, the growth, and the cool things, and even the playful things that we've made progress in and learned along the way, we tend to just go negative all the time and draw people down back into that muck and mire that leads to the frustrations of, you know, this sort of work.
And I think one of the things I would say is that, you know, we have to empower people to look after themselves and in a sense you get a bit of a pushback. And I mean, and that's why I think having a framework is important, which says, this is what we are doing and this is what our bottom line expectations are, right? And that's great to say, as a staff, these are things we commit to in terms of our planning, our professional development, our collaboration, et cetera. But I don't think we set a bar as what where the top is to say, okay, at this point in time, once you exceed this, you're actually now being detrimental to yourself, you've been detrimental to your colleagues, you've been detrimental to the students. And if we actually look at that in terms of, you know, where that's at, and as I said to you, you know, when you in education, one of the classic ones that came out of the study was that we should encourage people to do master's level study. Great. But the return drops. You don't have the same return when you go up to a doctoral level. So if we said to everybody, now get on everybody do a doctorate, we'd have all these burned out stuff, and the return would actually be quite minimal in terms of what's there, you know, in terms of what we're actually doing. And so I think setting those bars and so giving people permission to say, actually, it's the holidays now, or to have a saying, so you know what, we're not sending emails to each other after 7 o'clock at night. Do you mean that's it? We're just going to, or on our computers, we got a thing to say, thank you for your email. Every night it comes on, I'll be responding. I've now switched off the computer for tonight. I'll get to it first thing tomorrow morning when I'm in at work at 8 o'clock or whatever, but that's there. And so setting some boundaries around that or encourage behaviors. And in the first bit, you know, when you do that, you get pushback where people say, oh, we're slacking off and whatever. Because the thing is that you've got a tired person who's usually doing that, or somebody who is giving beyond what they should be doing. And the thing that they actually need is permission to say, you've done enough. Good and faithful servant. That's enough. You've completed what needs to take place. And in a sense, doing that, we've got to model that from the front that you know, that when the leader goes home, that it's not at 9 o'clock at night, that they're saying, you know what, I go home every night at 6:30 or 7 or whatever time it is, and I have dinner with my family every night. And we actually sit down to the dinner table. And, you know, I go to church every Sunday, and Sunday is a day where I actually dedicate this to God. And we actually set behaviors in place that are actually going to be sustainable. And yes, in the first bit, we will have a bit of pushback because people don't understand. We have pushback because people are burning themselves out, and you know, a drowning swimmer wants everybody else to drown with them. And then what we want to be able to say is then, now let's measure the impact of having a well staff. And when we have that, and it can be monetary in terms of, you know, turnover and a whole range of things that is satisfied. But what I would say is that when we intentionally look at the things that impact upon staff well-being, we'll see that student well-being improves. And ultimately what will happen is that their academic outcomes improve as well. And it's great to draw a line in the sand is to say, here's the day we did nothing and these were our results. And this is what happened when we started looking after our community and our staff, which then impacted our student well-being. And let's have a look at what that impact has been. And so from us, from looking at our relational schools now to staff well-being, we think that there could be somewhere between a 10 and 15% increase in all of those factors by looking after staff and students well.
Daniel, I'm just going to end it right there because that's the perfect place to end it. I appreciate your time. I look forward to sharing this with, you know, many of our friends, but then, you know, the broader world and then create ways to connect with you and with this work and all the cool things you're doing. And I appreciate your time today.
That's good. Thanks, Eric.